Okay, welcome to today's stakeholder session on the Operating Reserve Market Review, session number one. My name is Melissa Mitchell-Moyson, and I'm a regulatory analyst here at the ISO, and I will be facilitating today's stakeholder session. We're looking forward to having a productive conversation today on the OR Market Review. We have a lot to cover, so let's get started. Next slide, please. All personal information will be collected in accordance with the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. If you have any questions or concerns about how the information is being handled, you can contact the information on this slide. Next slide, please. All attendees are joining in webinar in listen-only mode, and the host will have attendees' cameras disabled and microphones muted. When asking or typing in a question, please state your name and last name and organization you're representing. There's two ways to ask questions for the Q&A portion. You can either raise your hands or type into the Q&A window. Next slide, please. I won't go through these slides in details. These are just how you use the Zoom. And I'll now pass it over to Nicole LeBlanc, the Director of Markets and Tariff.
You think I would have figured out the mute button by now, 2 years in? Oh, I'm starting the morning off with a joke. Sorry. So welcome, everybody. As Melissa mentioned, I'm Nicole LeBlanc, Director of Markets and Tariff at the ISO. Thanks for joining us here today. I see we've got 56 attendees logged in so far. We did get registration for nearly 100, so we're expecting to see a few more roll in. If we go to the next slide, I'm going to share a few introductory remarks to set the context for this initiative and the session today before handing it over to the team. We flew through the agenda there. If we could just go back to that briefly. So we're going to, as you can see, we're initiating the rule consultation process for this initiative, as we do envision that the outcome will be some rule changes. So starting right into that Rule 17 process. And today we're going to share background on the OR market design as it currently exists to make sure there's a shared understanding across all the stakeholders that are involved and interested today around its design and function before we shift into presenting on analysis that we've done, which indicates there is room for improvement through incremental changes to the design. After the break, we'll talk through, or Brendan will talk through, the items that we've identified that we want to explore as part of this engagement and consultation session to improve competition and price fidelity in the OR market. We have scheduled Q&A time throughout the morning, so we're hoping to have a discussion as we go. For introductions, if we could go to slide 8. You'll see across the camera screens here some likely familiar faces from the ISO's market team. Brendan Jewett, an economist with market design, will be doing most of the presentation today, but is here supported by myself, Nicole LeBlanc, Director of Markets and Tariff, as well as Rupa Louisson, the manager of market implementation, and Shazana Mills, the manager of market design. You'll see both Rupa and Shazana here as we're working through a transition or a handoff. As many of you, if you know Shazana, you might be aware that she is headed off to the next important role in her life of being a new mother pretty shortly here. And so her accountabilities for market design will be transitioning over to Rupa. And we've got qualified team ready for the handoff. So you're seeing the workings of it here this morning. You've already heard from Melissa, who's in our regulatory team, and then Valerie is also behind the scenes supporting us. So why are we here today? If we could switch to slide 9. We see we've got a few more people rolled in, so I'm glad we've got the majority of the folks here now, because I think this is a few important points that I want to make before we dive into the session this morning. So setting the context of this initiative, we're very much focused on assessing opportunities to enhance competition and price fidelity in the existing OR markets to improve efficiency. What's underneath that is an assessment that we do think the market is functioning. We're not evaluating wholesale change to address major issues, but more focused on really how can we unlock some opportunities to improve competitiveness and price fidelity within the current design to improve efficiency. And we think now is an important time to explore and implement these modifications. And I'll talk to why that is. The ISO in the market power mitigation advice that we provided to the minister back in November of 2019, we identified that competitive pressures in the OR market were a bit limited, and that there was that we should explore changes to increase competition to help mitigate any issues of market power and also unlock greater efficiencies in the market. And that's what we're really focused on with this initiative. We're focused on removing barriers to facilitate entry by additional qualified resources, as well as improving transparency and other modifications that can improve price fidelity, all with the focus of getting more effective competition and more efficient outcomes. And we are of the view that it's important to explore this initiative now, and with the lens of really finding incremental changes to the current design that we think is generally functioning, but has some areas for improvement for efficiency gains. I think a lot of you will have questions as to why now, or is this scope the right one? And the why now question comes from, I think, the view that there are a lot of changes on the horizon, both in a short-term perspective as well as a long-term perspective. And does the scope, why is the scope framed appropriately? So those two questions I want to tackle before we dive in. So framing up that short-term and long-term change or uncertainty, I think we're all well familiar that there's a significant amount of change expected in the electricity sector globally, but also in Alberta, as there are stronger and stronger carbon policy or objectives for the electricity market that could lead us to are expected to lead us to a very different fleet in the long term, which could come with the different requirements or for reliability type products, as well as different opportunities for market design to unlock those products. But our view is that those changes, which have the potential to be significant, are far enough into the future, are uncertain enough that it's important for us to make sure that we're unlocking the efficiencies that we can in the current OR market design for what might be an interim period prior to those more significant changes. And as an industry, we'll have to be working through those bigger, more foundational questions over the next years and decade. And having a competitive OR market underpinning that will be of benefit to all of us. The other more shorter term changes, I think many of you are aware that the ISO Alberta's experienced some frequency issues, four of them over the past 2 years, I think, and that the ISO is intensely working on how do we understand what's driving those issues and making changes to technical standards, rules, requirements, and potentially even market design to address them. And information was shared with stakeholders around that in a presentation October 7th related to grid reliability and operational preparedness. And there's a pretty significant list of actions that the ISO's taking to address those reliability concerns. And a small number of them could have implications to the OR market. And again, we see them as being incremental to the changes that we're talking about here today. And it remains important that we have a market design for the OR market that can support competition and efficient outcomes, even if there could be some incremental requirements on it from some of those changes. Another short-term activity that's underway, the ISO is evaluating the single largest contingency, and there's a stakeholder engagement activity running along with that. And again, in that situation, should there be changes to the single largest contingency, there could be implications to the products that we prefer from the OR market design, and we're of the view of having an efficient OR design to procure those products becomes even more important. So I guess that is how we view how those three pieces fit to, the three pieces fit together of longer term change, maybe some shorter term requirements of OR products, but underneath it we see the current OR market design functioning and the areas to make competitiveness improvements to it, and we see that as important to progress now as we envision relying on this OR market design for at least the foreseeable future. In all of that, though, I do want to highlight that as we're talking about the changes or the modifications, we're very much focused on incremental type changes to the OR design or modifications to the current current setup. And that's really focusing on the understanding that there could be some greater changes in the longer term. And so the investments that we make now need to match kind of the time period at which we would expect they would be in place for. And so we're presenting that to you today with a really laying out where we see the areas for opportunity are and the actual design options that we've identified. We've bucketed them into two groups today, where we're going to talk through group one, which we think are really the options that have clearly identifiable alternatives, broad benefits, and are simple to implement. And we think these are items that it's possible that we'll get some general agreement fairly quickly on how to proceed, and want to start sort of putting that to closure. And we've also identified group two, which are more significant design elements, or maybe not significant, but more complex and will require more analysis before identifying a path forward. We've shared the full suite of options that we've identified so that you have a lens of what we're looking at as we complete this review and look to gather input on either the options we've identified or also ones that you think that we may have missed, but all in that context of a narrow adjustments to the current market design to increase its competitiveness and its efficiencies. So with that, I'll just switch to the next slide, and maybe I touched on a little bit across the group one and group two already, but our views of how this initiative will shape out over the next year or so. We're looking to talk a significant amount about the background, the purpose, the scope, and the options that we've identified today. And then in March, shift into exploring, as I said, group two, which are the more complex changes, and bringing us to a bit of a resolution by mid next year to start shifting into progressing either changes that require rule changes or those that don't. So that's our plan. But as we said, we're here consulting with you today, and we're looking for input across kind of that full spectrum before we really start to shift into evaluating group one and group two. So I'll just pause here in case there's any questions for me around the comments I made, the general scope of this initiative, knowing that we have all morning to get into the details.
There is a question in the Q&A, Nicole. Santi asks, will the ISO be soliciting stakeholder feedback to session one?
Yes, for sure. We've got our comment matrix drafted. We just wanted to see how the conversation went today before finalizing it to identify if there's any incremental questions we want added. So that should be released shortly.
Thanks, Nicole. There's no other questions, no hands up.
Okay, well, I'll turn it over to Brendan then. Oh, I believe I covered this one. Sorry.
And it's over to me. Next slide, please. This is for our meeting minutes. Just a disclaimer that this session is being recorded. The meeting minutes will be prepared by the ISO and posted on, was circulated for comment and then posted on the ISO website. Organization names will be used to identify the contributions here today. Next slide, please. ISO stakeholder framework. As many of you are aware, in late 2019, the ISO established a new stakeholder engagement framework. Our engagement principles are inclusive and accessible, strategic and coordinated, transparent and timely, and customizing meaningful. And that's what we're here to do today. Next slide, please. Stakeholder participation. So today we'd like to listen to understand others' perspectives, disagree respectfully, balance airtime fairly, and keep an open mind. Next slide, please. ISO rule development requirements. So there are key legislation and regulatory provisions that grants the ISO authority to develop rules. So for ISO rules, it's section 20 of the EUA, and the AUC rule 17 governs how the ISO must engage with stakeholders on rule development. Next slide, please. And this diagram here shows the ISO rules process. And we are in box number one, which is the stakeholder engagement group being formed. And that's what we're doing here today. Now I will pass it over to Brendan Jewett, who is the economist for market design, to take it away.
Thanks, Melissa. And pardon me. Thank you for the introductory comments, Nicole. I think we can just move on to the next slide. So given the information about our purpose and scope that Nicole shared, I'm sure many people are eager to learn a little bit more about that. But before jumping into that, I want to share some information about the background of just the basics of OR, as well as that market power mitigation advice that Nicole was speaking to. And then I want to share a summary of some of the highlights of some historical analysis and observations that we've made that have helped us to inform that purpose and scope, and why we think that the purpose and scope is appropriate and is the best path forward. Next slide, please. So I think we have a variety of stakeholders joining us today, some of which will be very keenly familiar with all of the inner workings of the OR market, and some of which perhaps less so. So I do want to have a few slides here where I just establish a common baseline to make sure that we're all speaking the same language going forward. So operating reserves, they're a form of ancillary service, and they are procured to support reliability. There are two broad categories of operating reserves. There are regulating reserves and contingency reserves. Regulating reserves are used to correct for instantaneous imbalances between supply and demand, while contingency reserves are used to balance supply and demand when there's an unexpected system event. There are two forms of contingency reserves. We have spinning reserves, which are synchronized to the grid, and therefore they also provide primary frequency response in addition to that longer-term contingency response. And then we also have supplemental reserves that are not synchronized to the grid. Currently, we have supplemental reserves provided both by generators, which we refer to as SUPG, and by loads, which we refer to as SUPL. Technically speaking, loads are capable of providing both spinning and regulating reserves as well, provided that they make the necessary investments. But we have not seen any entry up to this point of loads in those other products. So today, they are generators and energy storage that provide those products. The ISO procures these reserves both as active reserves and standby reserves. And standby reserves are activated when the active portfolio is insufficient to meet our reserve needs. slide 21. So we procure OR day ahead in a series of auctions through an external platform called Wadex. And OR is procured for multi-hour time blocks or time shapes. And these products are procured sequentially. So we start with active regulating reserve, then active spin, active SUP, and then the markets close for standby regulating reserve, standby spin, and then standby SUP. The ISO is the sole buyer of these products. So the ISO buys reserves to meet our forecasted system needs. In order to do that, the ISO submits a volume and a bid price for each active product and for each time block. And the procurement volumes that the ISO gets from the market, they come from reliability standards and from technical studies. Slide 22, please. So the OR market is separate from the energy market, and it is cleared independently on that day-ahead basis. That being said, there is a link between the active OR market and the energy market, and that is the index pricing mechanism. So the price of active reserves are indexed to the energy price, and I can talk more about that in a little bit. Active reserves are priced using a uniform price model, which means that all cleared providers earn the same price, whereas standby reserves are cleared using a pay-as-bid model, which means that cleared providers will be paid based on what they offered into the market. And participation in the OR markets is voluntary. So participants that are qualified for OR may offer, as opposed to the must offer requirement we have for the energy market. Slide 23, please. So I'll just very quickly scan through the pricing mechanism, both in the active market and the standby market. If people do have questions to get more clarity on how these work, we're happy to take those during our Q&A period. So in the active market, OR sellers will submit a volume and a price into the market, and we determine the dispatch payment for these reserves based on what we call the equilibrium price formula. And so the equilibrium price is the average of the marginal clearing price, or in other words, the price of the highest offer block that clears the market, and the ISO bid price. And so as an example, if we had a $10 marginal clearing price in the market and the ISO bid price was $50, then the equilibrium price would be $30. And because of index pricing, this is indexed to the pool price. So in this case, that would be a $30 premium to the pool price. And so the seller would be paid the pool price plus $30. If an active reserve provider is directed to provide energy, in the case of a contingency, then they will also be paid the pool price for any megawatts that are delivered to the grid. Slide 24, please. In the standby market, there's a bit of a different pricing mechanism. So sellers submit a two-part offer that includes a premium price and an activation price. And the ISO clears the market using what we call the blended price formula. And so the blended price is equal to the premium plus the activation price weighted by an activation percentage. And the activation percentage is based on historical activation rates, and the percentages for different products and time blocks are shown in the following table. And so that blended price effectively acts as the expected value of standby price revenue. The premium price is an availability payment that is paid to standby providers for all hours in which they're dispatched to provide standby. The activation price is paid to the seller if the reserve is activated, or in other words, if a standby provider is activated to become an active OR provider. And then there's a similar directive payment that if once activated, a standby provider is directed to provide energy, they'll be paid the pool price for anything that flows to the grid. Slide 25. So just a quick example. In this case, we can see a set of offers that include both a premium and an activation price, as well as the volume. We require 40 megawatts. And so we weight these premium and activations into the blended price. And we take the lowest price 40 megawatts, which in this case would be the lowest three offers. And then recall that those three providers would be paid on a pay-as-bid basis based on their offers into the market. Slide 26, please. So just looking at operating reserve costs over time, we can see that for the past 8 years here, operating reserve costs have ranged from approximately $65 million to a projected $320 million for 2021. And that because we have that index pricing mechanism, OR costs have closely followed movement of the energy price through these years, which is what we would expect given the nature of operating reserves and the underlying cost fundamentals, which is something that I'll talk about more on a future slide. So the $65 million to $320, it is less costly than the energy market, but we still view that as being a substantial cost, and we'll use that as a frame of reference for determining the extent to which implementation costs and complexities outweigh benefits to the market. Slide 27. So Nicole mentioned the market power mitigation advice that we provided to the Minister of Energy before beginning this initiative. And so that occurred in 2019. And that report looked at both energy and OR markets, but conclusions for the OR markets were made in three broad areas. So the first was in concentration, and we found that the OR market is substantially concentrated in terms of market share, particularly in the regulating reserve market. Also looking at offer behavior, we found that there were instances where the structure, conduct, and performance of the OR market did not deliver competitive or efficient outcomes. And also that the expiry of the hydro PPA, which is something that I'll speak more to later for those that may not be familiar, may increase the incentive to exercise market power. And then the third conclusion regarding efficiency was that incremental exercise of market power in the OR markets may not correspond to long-run efficiency benefits. And so when we talk about incremental exercise of market power, to the extent that there's market power exercised in the energy market, that would be expected to flow through to some extent into the OR market through the index pricing mechanism. And those of you who have participated in our energy market initiatives will be familiar with the trade-off we often speak to about short-run and long-run efficiency, and that additional market power in the OR markets above and beyond the revenue that flows through from the energy market may not result in the same long-run efficiency benefits that we look at in the energy market. Slide 28, please. So this figure is just taken out of that report, and it shows the concentration ratio of qualified OR capacity for 2019 and 2021. The concentration ratio is a metric that shows the highest combined market share that's held by a given number of market participants. And so in this case, we look at the CR4 and the CR5, or the largest four and five participants respectively. Particularly in the regulating reserve product, we can see here that the qualified OR capacity is quite concentrated. And so just for reference, the Competition Bureau in their merger enforcement guidelines, they state that concerns with efficiency impacts from the exercise of market power, they may arise with a concentration ratio of four participants above 65%. That doesn't necessarily mean that there are concerns at that level, but just that it warrants further consideration. And so we can see the regulating reserve market in particular exceeds that, and the spinning reserve market gets close as well. For anyone that's interested in looking at this report in more detail. It is available on the ISO website, and we speak a little more about the conclusions we've made in the report. Slide 29, please. So with that background, I can now go into some of the analysis that we've done leading up to the session today. Next slide, please. So after the market power mitigation report, we really had three objectives for the analysis we did. The first is to develop a set of economic objectives. For those of you that are familiar with the ISO economic principles, those are objectives to add context and more specific detail to the economic principles in the context of the OR markets. We also want to summarize and augment the previous analysis that was done in order to isolate what the key issues were, and then also analyze the impact of the hydro PPA expiry. And again, for those of you that may not be familiar, I will provide some more detail on that in an upcoming slide. Next slide, please. So slide 31, some economic considerations about the OR market. So there are a variety of reasons that economic efficiency is a little challenging to quantify in the OR markets compared to the energy market. So again, for those of you that have participated in some of our recent energy market initiatives, you'll know that we like to be able to quantify efficiency where possible, and it allows us to make good cost-benefit comparisons. However, there are some challenges to the OR market that mean that some of our modeling techniques or assumptions may not work the same way in OR as they do in energy. So firstly, whereas we use a explicit marginal cost when we're modeling the energy market, that includes things like fuel price, carbon price, those sorts of things. In OR, instead, there's a more complex and sometimes intertemporal opportunity cost that is the fundamental driver for OR pricing. Also, there are exogenous operational and environmental constraints that affect the availability and the capability of some of our largest OR providers. And also, the ISO is the sole buyer in the OR markets. And so that means that that effectively eliminates all of the demand side modeling that we would normally do. Next, when we're looking at the state of competition in the markets, there's a challenge there as well, because the OR market does not have a must-offer requirement like the energy market does. So if you just look into the OR markets and you're looking at offered volumes in those markets, that will generally understate the competitive pressure in those markets, because qualified volumes that are not offered into the market would be able to respond to an exercise of market power in the OR markets. So we think that using qualified volumes is a more accurate reflection of competition in these markets, and that's what we did in our market power mitigation advice to the minister. And then finally, other jurisdictions, they may have substantially different mechanisms for procuring and pricing and dispatching OR products compared to what we do in Alberta. However, when making comparisons, we must consider that Alberta does not have separate mechanisms for the recovery, the offer and recovery of commitment costs, such as startup costs and no-load costs, as well as fixed capital costs. And so our market design needs to take that into account. Slide 32, please. So here we have the economic principles that we've used on several initiatives. Those are competition, effective operations and pricing, cost, and public interest. And so I'll just quickly outline the objectives that we've determined correspond to these principles for the purpose of us assessing changes to the OR markets. Firstly, competition across the energy and operating reserve markets should be maximized. So we think that to the extent possible, participants should be free to allocate their capacity across those markets in a competitive fashion. We also want to minimize barriers to entry to ensure that we're enabling the most competition in those markets. And we need to ensure that the market design does not enable any anti-competitive practices. For effective operations and pricing, we think that price signals should be the key determining factor to guide efficient capacity allocation across the energy and operating reserve markets. Price signals should send a signal that incents efficient investment in capacity that's capable of providing operating reserves. And the framework should enable participation by assets that are well suited to providing reserves. So to the extent that there are assets or technology types that are well suited to providing reserves, we want to make sure that the market design is able to unlock that value. The operating reserve markets should also be designed and operated in alignment with the technical standards and product definitions. So we want to make sure the market design aligns with the way that these products are defined and the way that they're used in practice. For cost, the opportunity for cost recovery, that includes both short-run marginal costs, commitment costs, fixed costs, should exist across both the energy and operating reserve markets. And the cost of administering the operating reserve markets should be minimized. And finally, any changes that we make to the operating reserve market design should have a clear justification to avoid any unnecessary disruption to market stability. Next slide, please. Okay, so one analysis we did in 2020 was to take a closer look at liquidity following the market power mitigation advice. And we found that liquidity for the regulating reserve product was limited, while spinning reserves and supplemental reserves had much more active participation. And so in the following table, we can see the average volume that was offered for each product in excess of the traded volume, so the amount of volume that was left after the market cleared. And this includes observations from May of 2019 to April of 2020. And the percentages that are shown in the table here, they indicate the average excess offers as a percentage of average procurement volume. And so when we look at the regulating reserve product, we can see that there are substantially lower volumes compared to spinning reserve and supplemental. That being said, on a percentage basis, even in the lowest case here, we see 29% for on-peak regulating reserve, which may not be that concerning. But one thing to keep in mind is that these are averages. So we do see these volumes fluctuate up and down based on things like forced outages, planned outages of reserve providers, those sorts of things. And also, we also see that for the greater participation in the contingency reserve products, that's improved over time as the result of new entry from both traditional assets as well as new providers such as storage and load providers. Next slide, please. So also in 2020, we conducted two participant surveys that were that included market participants that have capability qualified to provide OR. The purpose of these surveys was to look at limited OR participation and to ask these providers to the extent that they may not actively participate in the OR markets, what the reasoning was. One of the surveys focused primarily on regulating reserve, while the other was looking at all the OR products. And we found the following themes in responses that were heard from participants. First, we heard that there may be technical and operational restrictions that prevent more entry or more participation. For example, the 5 megawatt offer size threshold that we currently have. We also heard that there may be prohibitive complexity that prevents market participants from wanting to participate in the markets. And then we also heard that there may be some participants whose offers are priced out of the market, meaning that they tried to participate and they find that they just were not clearing the market. And finally, that there may have been other products and services with more attractive prices, and market participants preferred to allocate their capability over to those other products and services. And so our kind of highest level conclusion from this is that it appears there are some potential barriers that warrant further exploration, for instance, with the technical and operational restrictions and any prohibitive complexity, but that there are also efficient reasons that participants are allocating their capability out of operating reserves, and that to the extent that a participant is just responding to a price signal, we think that's just part of the efficient market functioning. Next slide, please. The next observation we've made relates to the activation price for standby reserves. And so in this case, we've borrowed from the MSA's Q3 2021 report, their most recent report, in order to show an example of what we're talking about. And so we see that for spinning reserve in particular, the activation prices are quite often higher than the energy price, as well as the active spinning reserve price. And we think that that shouldn't be occurring frequently, although there may be rare instances where you could conceive of an instance where maybe it would make sense. It certainly should not be the norm, as reserve providers do not incur their full marginal costs of producing energy. So another way to frame this is that a provider that is on that is providing standby reserve and is ready to respond to a activation, they're still eligible to provide energy. So they may be participating in the energy market, earning the pool price, and then based on their activation price, we would pay them a price higher than the pool price in order to stop producing energy and to become an active OR provider. And as we said, that we don't think that that should be the standard or most common market outcome. Next slide, please. So to summarize some of the observations we've made, both market liquidity as well as the results from our participant surveys have indicated to us that the current market design is not maximizing competition. And also, it's unclear whether the historical outcomes that we've observed are being driven by the market design or by incentives that are created by the hydro PPA. And that's something that was brought up in the market power mitigation advice. And we've also observed pricing outcomes that do not appear to be efficient. So I've already spoken to the standby activation prices, but another observation we've made relates to the prices of products relative to each other. And so we've seen price inversions where products that have more rigorous technical requirements and therefore you'd expect less competition are being priced below products with lower requirements. So for instance, with spinning reserve and supplemental reserve, spinning reserve has higher technical requirements to be able to provide. And so we would expect that any participant that's qualified to provide spinning reserve could also provide supplemental reserve. Despite that, the price for supplemental reserve has historically exceeded the spinning reserve price in approximately 20 to 80 days per year, even though we'd expect that spinning reserve providers should be able to respond to that price signal and move into the supplemental reserve market. It is worth noting that we say 20 to 80 days per year, but generally over the last few years, that trend has been declining, which is a promising sign and is likely due to a new entry in the supplemental market in particular. Next slide, please. So I've mentioned the hydro PPA a few times, and so here I'm just going to briefly describe it and talk about some of our observations. So the hydro PPA, it was a contract that was formed during deregulation of the market, and it expired at the end of last year, at the end of 2020. And our understanding of the hydro PPA is that it provided strong financial incentives to ensure that a significant portion of hydro capability was scheduled to provide OR. And so the ISO has analyzed the market before the expiry of the hydro PPA and after the expiry of the hydro PPA. And we do not believe that the state of the market has materially changed. So that indicates to us that conclusions that were drawn from observations of the market before the hydro PPA expiry should still be applicable to the current state of the market. OR prices, equilibrium prices, have generally remained constant or have declined through 2021. And so that indicates that to the extent that there is a change in incentives from the hydro PPA expiry, it has not led to any increased prices at this time. And the ISO continues to assess the market to ensure that the market design is promoting efficiency, while the Market Surveillance Administrator, or the MSA, their role is to monitor the market for anti-competitive behavior. Next slide, please. I mentioned that OR prices have generally remained constant or declined through 2021. And so just to show a little bit of data for that, here we see the monthly average equilibrium prices for active on-peak regulating spin and SUP. And so we can see prices were relatively stable through 2019. Through 2020, we saw a deviation in regulating reserve prices that I'll speak to in a second. But then in 2021, we've seen continued stability while supplemental prices in particular have been declining through 2021. As I mentioned, regulating reserve prices were abnormal in 2020. We believe this is primarily due to a reduction in procurement volume that occurred in May due to updated technical studies. And then because of that reduced volume combined with a very steep merit order or offer curve for operating reserves, we saw a substantial decrease in price during that time. And then it took a few months for the market to adjust to that procurement volume going into the end of 2020. That being said, regulating reserve prices, looking back earlier than 2019, historically, having an equilibrium price, something between zero and minus 50 was typical. Next slide, please. So now that I've shared some of the background analysis, a little more of the basics of OR, I think that's set us up to talk a little bit more about the purpose and scope of this initiative. Next slide, please. Nicole already shared our purpose statement, but I will reiterate that our historical findings and our economic objectives have informed the following statement, which is that this initiative will assess opportunities to enhance competition and price fidelity in the existing OR markets to improve efficiency. Slide 41, please. So I'm going to provide some more context to each of the components of that statement to give a little more information of how they translate into this initiative. So for enhanced competition, we believe the scope includes removing barriers to entry to enable new entry from assets that are technically capable of providing OR. We also want to make sure that the market design can support competitive outcomes. So we want to ensure that the market design and parameters are not restricting the normal competitive functioning of the market. And we want to facilitate the appropriate level of transparency. So we know that transparency plays an important role to foster an information-rich environment and a level playing field. But we also know that in some instances, transparency can lead to the potential for anti-competitive behavior. And so we want to make sure that have transparency in the market at the right level. Slide 42, please. So for enhanced price fidelity, more detail on the scope includes that we want to remove unnecessary complexity. So we want to simplify pricing where possible to encourage clear price signals while still ensuring that we have the pricing structure and different pricing components that we need. We want to improve the offer strategy incentives in the market. So we want to have strong incentives for market participants to offer in a manner that promotes efficiency. And we want to ensure that the pricing mechanism aligns cost with value, cost and value rather, so that it is reflective of the underlying cost and value of each product. Next slide. We also say that we're looking for change within the existing OR markets. And so that means the existing suite of products. So any potential need for new operating reserve products is not part of the scope of this market-focused assessment. That being said, as Nicole mentioned, we are closely working internally with our operations team on some other ongoing initiatives to ensure that we're aligned and that we're capturing efficiencies where possible. The day-ahead format of the existing OR markets, we believe that the day-ahead procurement using the WADEX platform can accommodate our current proposed scope of changes. And so we don't see a need to make that adjustment to the structure in order to capture the benefits that we're aiming for in this initiative. And we also want to limit change where possible to the OR markets. And so broader changes that impact the structure of both the energy and the AS markets, we don't believe are necessary to address the currently identified issues with competition and price fidelity. Next slide, please. So here we have a comparison of some high-level components of the Alberta model or the market design for energy and operating reserves, as well as the FERC model that's employed by many of the ISOs in the United States. So I won't go through each component of this in detail, but what we're trying to capture here is that we don't believe that restructuring of the Alberta market is necessary to address the currently identified issues. So there are a number of differences between the Alberta and FERC model, such as the voluntary versus must offer participation, frequent versus infrequent security constraints, as well as market driven versus administrative pricing. And we think that a lot of those elements, they work in tandem alongside each other. And we don't believe that calling those broader elements of the structure into the scope of this initiative is necessary to address the issues that we've identified. And next slide, please. So just to summarize the scope, again, as Nicole mentioned, we believe that at a high level, the market is functioning in that we've been able to procure the volumes of products we need. We have seen costs over the years generally track the energy market, which is what we would expect. But there are several design elements that we think are not performing in a way that promotes efficiency, and that incremental change should be sufficient to address those concerns, emphasizing the importance of OR going forward, both economically and operationally. And some future considerations, even though this initiative is pursuing incremental change, that doesn't mean that the ISO would never consider a broader change. So to the extent that we do a longer term assessment or we identify a need as the system and fleet evolve, we may consider a broader market change like co-optimization in the future. And also that the market design may need to adapt to accommodate any new OR products that are identified. So we believe that making sure that the OR market is set up with an efficient baseline that is promoting competition, it's sending good price signals, that'll be even more imperative to the extent that we are adding any new volumes or any new products into the market. So we don't see a need for that at this time, but we want to ensure that the OR market's well positioned to potentially incorporate those changes in the future. Next slide. So with that, I believe we're moving to our first open discussion period. Next slide. I think we have some kind of questions to kick things off, but we're welcoming any feedback. But just to quickly run through these questions, in particular, we're wondering whether there are any additions or modifications to the economic objectives that I shared, whether there are any relevant historical market outcomes that have not been analyzed, and also whether we've clearly defined both the scope and the purpose. And just also a reminder, following on to Santi's question earlier, that we will be soliciting feedback through our stakeholder comment matrix. So you're welcome to give more detailed responses within that matrix after the session today.
Okay, Brendan, we do have three questions in the Q&A. Do you want to start with those? So Santi from Capital Power says, from an RR perspective, and the table at slide 33, how much does liquidity change when using the available qualified volumes instead of excess supply that was offered?
So I think available qualified volumes can be a little challenging because while we may see the available capability in the energy market in terms of the AC of a unit, we don't necessarily know whether that asset is positioned to provide reserves as well. That being said, I believe we do have a breakdown of those metrics under different circumstances, so including qualified volumes, including offered volumes, and perhaps a couple other ways to quantify those metrics. I think all of those are available in the market power mitigation report that is posted on our website.
Okay.
Susanna,
do you have anything to add? Oh, I think that's perfect. So the next question comes from Megan Gill, also with Capital Power. Are the results of the 2020 participant survey publicly available?
Brendan, I can take this one.
Sure.
So essentially, the survey was shared with the expectation that the results would be kept confidential. And so because of that, we have received quite a bit of commercially sensitive type information in those responses that we wouldn't be able to share. So what we've done here is just shared the highlights essentially and the themes of what we've heard so you can get a general indication of what are some of the different challenges or barriers that participants are facing.
And then we have another question from Luis Pando Lopez. He's a consultant. Do you have concentration levels or of the OR market in terms of Herfindahl-Hirschman index? What type of competition assessment was done? Did the ISO use the Competition Bureau competition assessment or the OECD toolkit or a different method?
So I don't believe that we shared HHI or Herfindahl-Hirschman index statistics in the market power mitigation advice. I think ultimately it's just another way of describing the same information roughly. So we did decide to go with the concentration ratio approach, which was based on, I think, as I mentioned earlier, the merger enforcement guidelines from the Competition Bureau. And I think, again, reiterating what I said, I believe in response to Santi's comment, that I think there are a few other calculations using different assumptions within the market power mitigation report. But we, I believe, concluded that the concentration ratio using qualified capacity was probably the best representation of the competitive forces in the market at any given time.
Luis, if you have any follow-up, you can go ahead and type that into the Q&A, or you can raise your hand. We do have somebody with their hand raised, Alexandra Dunlop from Suncor. I'm going to put her through. Okay, you should be able to unmute on your side.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. I have a question on slide 35. Where you compare the standby spinning activation prices to energy prices. I just want to clarify, are you comparing the standby spinning activation prices to the average pool price or the hours that the volume was activated? Because if it's – yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry, you can finish your question and then I'll respond.
I was just going to say typically we see activations in the higher price hours because higher price hours entice more imports, which results in more activations. So if you're comparing that to the average pool price, I would say that's not really a fair comparison.
Yeah, I agree. So it's the prevailing price of energy. So this was prepared by the MSA and not by the ISO internally, but my understanding of their report and the way that they've explained it is that it is the prevailing price during the time of the standby activation, not the average price.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Dr. Andrew. Okay, so we have two more questions in the Q&A. We have Akira from TransAlta, and the ISO has historically reduced the volumes it has procured. How has the ISO analyzed, taken into account the impacts of those decisions on market participants' interests in the OR market?
Sorry, Melissa, would you please just read that one more time?
Yeah, no problem. The ISO has historically reduced the volumes it has procured. How has the ISO analyzed, taken into account, the impacts of those decisions on market participants' interests in the OR market?
So I think the procurement volumes for reserves are determined through, as I was mentioning earlier, reliability standards and then also internal technical studies. And so the impact to market participants' revenue or investment signals, that sort of thing, that's not a factor in determining our reserve volumes. Instead, we do that on an operational basis. And so we think that it's important that the market design is set up in a way that it can reflect those reserve volume requirements and then send signals that are appropriate for those volume requirements to the type of long-run investment we need in capability. But we don't decide how much reserve to procure based on, you know, revenue sufficiency or something like that. We think the causation should go the other way around. I may just add to that, though, that, you know, if you do have feedback on how those decisions impact kind of long-run dynamics, investment, those sorts of things, and how the market is or is not performing in sending those signals, I think we are very interested to hear that and to potentially address those sorts of things within this initiative.
Okay. Next, we have Parang Menon from Heartland Generation. There was a comment about standby activation price being more than active OR price or energy price, and an explanation that it should not happen. But as OR is procured day ahead, the standby activation is fixed price. The market participant takes a risk of what would be an opportunity cost they could lose if the energy price is more than the fixed price they bid for the day ahead offer. So one should factor that.
So I agree that I think in the current market design of standby reserves, it makes sense that there's a risk premium and that there's uncertainty that's going to be factored into those prices. It is, I still think, surprising to see sustained and persistent markups for standby activations over those other prices. That being said, I think that there's no indication based on what we've seen and that the MSA's reports that there's any sort of anti-competitive behavior that's leading to those outcomes. We think that it really is just an indication that perhaps the pricing mechanism could be improved so that those price signals better align with each other to provide the right incentives between the different products. So in summary, definitely agree with the point that there are considerations in the current design that could lead to that. But we think that that's perhaps a reason that the current design could maybe be adjusted.
Okay. We have one more question in the Q&A, and then Akira has his hand up. So I'll go to the question, the last question in the Q&A, and then we'll go to Akira. Oh, and of course, this is coming on too here. Okay, so we have Richard Penn from ICTA. Will changes in MSSC affect the ISO OR market design, especially if the contingency size increases?
Brendan, I can take this one. Just for the background and benefit of those that were that have not been involved in the MSSC stakeholder work that's been led by our operations group. The MSSC is the most severe single loss of supply contingency that the power system can absorb without impacting reliability and tripping customer load. The current static MSSC is 466 megawatts. Some of the drivers behind the consideration of increasing the MSSC are things like larger single connection projects, larger coal to gas conversion projects, increasing penetration of renewables and distribution energy resources. However, there are reliability and technical reasons for the current MSSC that need to be considered if it's increased. So for example, recent UFLS events have shown challenges with increased penetration of renewable resources and DERs, declining inertia, inconsistent system response. We are still receiving stakeholder feedback, and there has not been a decision on whether the MSSC will be increased. So kind of going back to Richard's question, this consultation is intended to increase efficiency and competitiveness in the OR market. So any products or changes that result from the MSSC engagement will be coordinated with market design, and the changes that we are progressing for OR set us up, as Nicole and Brendan have mentioned, to move forward with implementing any future changes in an efficient manner. So for example, if OR volumes increase as a result of MSSC changes, it is even more critical that we are ensuring that the OR market is maximizing competition and sending efficient price signals. In any event, there are benefits that can be captured now with the current suite of products.
Thank you, Rupa. Okay, so I'm going to go to Akira now, and I'm just going to allow you to talk, and then you should be able to now unmute. This is Akira from TransAlta.
Thank you. Yeah, Akira from TransAlta. I think my question wasn't understood properly, but maybe I can understand your perspective from contingency. But the ISO has made changes to the procurement volumes in the past. And I think the reductions of those procurement volumes does send a signal. And I'm not sure how the ISO is considering its design of the procurement volumes and such, and takes any of those factors in terms of participation or interest in participating in the OR market. So I just kind of posit that out there, that you are the designer of these markets. Your signals in terms of adjusting volumes and what you procure does send signals to the market that does change interest for market participants. So I think it's an important factor to take into consideration any of the analysis that you're doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Definitely something for us to keep in mind. Thank you. I think I will just reiterate, and I know you know this, that the procurement volumes do come from those technical studies and reliability standards, but you are right that we've changed those volumes in the past, and that it's important to keep in mind that that does send a signal to the market and can impact the incentives for participation. So that's definitely something we'll keep in mind going forward.
Yeah, and just to add to that too, Akira, I think, yeah, so definitely, you know, I think we're the sole buyer, so the sole buyer will have an influence, of course, in terms of, you know, setting the amount of volume that we actually require for the market. But if you have any thoughts on, you know, those impacts and any additional comments to share, we are really interested to hear more from you. So if you can share that as part of your comment matrix, some thoughts for us to consider going forward, I think that would be really helpful.
Hello?
Oh, Melissa, I think you're on mute. Sorry.
Hi.
Of course, you should be good to come through.
Hi, can you hear me? Okay, excellent. Thank you. It's Horst Klinkenborg from Suncor. One comment I had on the whole standby activation question that has been kind of asked now a couple of times. I think given the fact that in our market design, the pool price distribution is heavily skewed, you would always assume that the expected pool price is higher than the actual pool price. So, and with that in mind, given that you're trading day ahead and kind of you're locking in a price, you would look at more the expected price. So you would always lock in a price, and 99% of the hours, you would expect that the pool price actually settles below that activation price that you've kind of transacted at. But you do run the risk of having blowout hours, which would be massively above your price, and you would have this massive opportunity loss. So I think that's really the issue, is that the pool price distribution is so skewed, which I think inherently means that you would trade above what's probably going to happen in the market. It's just, yeah, you have this massive risk of a blowout. But I also have a question, and that is, did the ISO have a look at, kind of in hindsight, what the ideal suite of AS providers would have been in the market? And then to maybe compare what the actual providers look like and whether that kind of matches up closely, because I think that would be a way to look at the efficiency of the market if it actually results in the correct resources providing the products that you're looking for. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Horst. So firstly, just thank you for that clarification and insight to the standby activation. I think all that makes sense to me, and that'll be really important context to keep in mind, especially as we go forward to evaluating the standby pricing mechanism. To your question, your question just totally evaporated out of my mind. I'm sorry, Horst.
Could you No problem. I talked too much, probably. The question was, did you look at who you are in hindsight? Ideal AS providers would have been, for example, a hydro unit, which is capacity rich, energy poor, but synchronized to maybe provide spinning reserve.
Right.
A marginal unit probably providing regulating reserve because it's already ramping on the margin. So it's like, from an efficiency perspective, those would be your ideal providers, like peakers that are out of market providing supplemental reserve. And then to look at, okay, this would be the ideal mix if I was the benevolent system operator that could control who's providing what. And now I'm looking at, does the market deliver? Does the market get me close to this outcome? Because then the market allocates the resources efficiently.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for repeating that. So I think the simple answer to your question is no. So we did not do that. I think some of the different elements that you just mentioned, I think those highlight that there are lots of kind of interesting and complex intertemporal factors that go into which providers would be the most efficient to provide OR at a given time, given who's ramping, given like opportunity cost potentially shifting between different times as you know, like some people may value operating reserve based on an opportunity cost that doesn't correspond with the simultaneous energy price, that sort of thing, commitment costs, startup costs, minimum run times, all those sorts of things. So I think we're interested in, you know, being able to do that. And if you have some insight into how we might be able to feasibly do that, I think we'd be definitely interested to hear more about that. And I might just add one other kind of barrier, I think, is that an option to doing that might be just to plug all of our assets into kind of one of the available sort of simulation models out there. But part of the issue is that, as you know, we don't use an optimization algorithm, a SCED or something like that, for the energy market. So then it may also end up, you know, redispatching the energy market to some extent too. So I think definitely hear all of the points you're making, and we'd be interested in learning that sort of information. And if you have an idea of how we can kind of feasibly go forward with that, then we'd be interested to hear that.
We've got 4 minutes left for the Q&A. There's a couple more questions in the Q&A. So I'll just pop over to those quickly. We have Andrea Thiessen from Heartland. As stated earlier, frequency events in the province have been increasing, yet we see the procurement of primary frequency response, OR, decreasing. Has ISO analyzed the impact on frequency response of reducing SR volume procurement?
So I think that any analysis that on frequency response in particular, or, you know, new products, as Nicole had mentioned right at the start, it's happening separately as part of our long-term review of, you know, frequency in general, flexibility requirements as the fleet changes. And what we'll do is we will, of course, stay coordinated with that work and as it's ongoing and for the long-term assessment. So at this point, we don't have anything to share in terms of how this might impact our existing OR products or existing OR volumes. But as I mentioned, we will stay closely coordinated with the operations folks so that we can ensure that we're aligned.
Thank you, Shoshana. So we have one last question and a couple of minutes left. Mark McGilvery from NMAX Corporation has a question. The FEOC reg uses 30% of offer control as a level of unacceptable concentration. Do we have more than 30% of concentration by a single participant in any of the OR products? If yes, would that not indicate market power and unacceptable considerations or concentration that inhibits competition? Is the FEOC level of 30% relevant to the ISO's assessment?
So I think we may need to double check the numbers just to respond whether there is or isn't anything in excess of 30%. That being said, I think the FEOC regulation and its requirements for the energy market, I think they form a helpful reference point or a way to consider the OR market, but I don't think that the FEOC requirements necessarily translate to the energy market, you know, just one-to-one. That being said, we have, as you've seen, we've done some analysis of the OR market, and at this time, we don't believe that there is market power harming the efficiency of the market in terms of any kind of anti-competitive behavior or just economic withholding or something like that. So it is something that we monitor, and I think that also stresses the importance of kind of half of the purpose of this initiative, which is increasing competition. And so we do think, based on what we've heard from participants, that there are market participants that are interested in providing OR that can't today. And so the purpose of this initiative is to investigate whether there are barriers that we can remove to perhaps facilitate new participation and make sure we're capturing whatever kind of benefits we can from that.
Thanks, Brendan. So if there's no more questions at the moment, and it's 10:20 and we had planned for a break at 10:20. So we'll be back in 10 minutes. So we'll reconvene at 10:30. Okay, Brendan, did you wanna take us away for the second half?
Sure, sounds good. One thing I'll just mention before we go forward is that I believe in response to one of Santi's questions in the Q&A box, we have posted a link to the Market Power Mitigation Report. So if anyone is interested to see the metrics maybe quantified under different assumptions or any other information stemming from that report, then please feel free to have a look at that link. My voice seemed to start going out on me a little bit in the last section, so hopefully I make it through the next one. We'll see. But bear with me if I need a few extra water breaks. Next slide, please. I think we can just dive in. All right, thank you. So we've kind of explained a little more detail about our purpose and scope in the last section. And so now hopefully we can take that to move into some of the items, some of the design elements that we believe are in scope. As Nicole mentioned, we divided these in scope items into two groups, which I'll talk about in a second here. But the way that we identified these design elements was using the economic objectives and also our historical findings to see where there may be opportunities for improvements. And we've categorized them in the groups based on their relative complexity and impact. Next slide, please. All right, so for these first four design elements in group one, it's our view that the alternatives for these design elements are more clear. The benefits are likely broader. And based on just very initial assessment that we've done, we think that the implementation cost and or complexity is on the lower end, although we have not secured final estimates of implementation cost or anything like that for these. We think it's important that we work through the alternatives with all of you first to make sure that we're prudently exploring the right options in more detail. And so we are ready to discuss the considerations of these design elements and our ISO proposed alternative in this session and to collect feedback in our stakeholder comment matrix on these alternatives. And even though we have a proposed alternative, these are not final recommendations by any means. So we are very appreciative of any feedback you have on these recommendations, as well as if there are any other alternatives that maybe we haven't considered that you think warrant further review. So with that, I think we can go into the next slide. So the first design element I'd like to speak about today is equilibrium pricing and the ISO bid price, sort of as a combined design element. So I briefly described it earlier, but I'll just go over it quickly again. So the equilibrium price in the active OR markets is determined by averaging the marginal clearing offer and the ISO bid price. And ISO bid prices are not visible to parties outside the WADEX platform. So if you are a OR participant and you are trading on WADEX, you can see the ISO's bid price once it's submitted. But other parties are not able to see that price if they're not on WADEX. And an active reserve provider that is dispatched to provide reserve will be paid this equilibrium price, which, recall, is an index. So this could be a premium or a discount, plus the energy pool price. So they'll be paid, basically, if the equilibrium price was minus 10, they'd be paid $10 less than the energy pool price. And then we're calling it that separate from the directive payment, if they are then directed to flow energy, in which case they will earn the pool price for that energy as well. So a few considerations for this current practice. Firstly, we expect that a competitive market participant would account for equilibrium pricing in their offer strategy. So they can see the ISO bid and they may desire to offer at a particular price level. And so they would be able to induce what the offer price would be for them to clear the market at a certain price level. And so we think sophisticated market participants, they'll be able to account for this pricing mechanism. However, it just basically adds an added complication to their offer strategy and may not be perfectly accounted for by smaller participants. Also, the ISO bid price that we submit is a direct input in the price setting mechanism. So to the extent that it's not perfectly accounted for in offer strategy, the bid price that the ISO sets will always influence the clearing price of the market in every single procurement, as opposed to, say, the energy market, where the price cap only becomes a factor in those sort of scarce and relatively rare hours. Next slide, please. So our proposed alternative is to remove the equilibrium pricing formula and instead clear the market at the marginal offer. So participants would still submit an offer. This offer would still be an index to the energy pool price, but it would no longer be averaged with the ISO bid price. And then the ISO bid price would effectively be replaced with a price cap. And then that price cap would be publicly disclosed. So this would align with the energy market. The principles that we would use for setting the price cap in the OR markets would be very similar to the energy market, and that we would want to put a limit on the extent to which market power can be exercised under very scarce circumstances, but that largely the price cap would be set in a way so that the ISO isn't influencing the normal competitive functioning of the market. And we expect that market participants would be able to adjust their offer strategy somewhat quickly to account for this fact that we're no longer averaging with the ISO bid price. Next slide, please. The next design element that we'd like to talk about today is standing offers. And so currently, we do not have standing offers in the OR market. So that means that market participants for each procurement that they want to participate in, they must submit new offers each day to the WADEX platform. And so while for some participants, this may not be a big deal and it's just part of their normal trading operations, for others, this increased burden may reduce the willingness to actively participate in the market. And this is based on what we were hearing from the participant survey, that we think that's especially true for participants whose assets would only rarely clear the market, that if you're submitting an OR offer and it's unlikely that you would clear unless perhaps there's an outage of a more frequent provider or something like that, that you may not have the incentive to actively go in there every day and to submit offers. And so our proposed alternative is to allow for market participants to submit standing offers. And these offers would carry forward and be automatically included in future trading intervals. And those offers would remain on the platform until they're changed by a participant or if the trader that submitted the offer was deactivated. Next slide, please. All right, so offer transparency is the next topic. So the current practice of transparency in the OR markets, offers to the WADEX platform are visible to all OR market participants as soon as they have been submitted. So participants will be able to see the offer price and volume of other participants once those offers have been submitted into the market, which diverges from the practice in the energy market. And in response to this, what we've observed is that many participants will submit their offers in the final moments of each procurement. And when I say final moments, for some participants, that's literally a matter of milliseconds or a fraction of a second. We suspect that there's a few reasons for that. One largely just being that if they do submit an offer, then another participant may be able to undercut their offer with a high degree of precision. And so they wait until the last moment. But if participants maybe have other reasons for doing that, we would be interested to hear that. Regarding the disclosure of offer information outside the WADEX platform, we currently release offer information on a 60-day lag. However, this is a little different from the offer disclosure that we have in the energy market. So for active volumes, we only include the clearing price, so not the offer price, only the equilibrium price. Whereas for standby, we do disclose both the activation and premium, as standby is pay as bid. And the other difference is that these offers are only shown for participants that clear the market. So if you submit an offer, but your offer is not accepted, that offer information will never be disclosed outside the WADEX platform. So a few considerations with this. Fully transparent offer information while the auction is being conducted may create the opportunity for anti-competitive practices. We know that the disclosure of information in the energy market is very prescriptively defined throughout the FEOC regulation and AUC decisions, whereas we don't have that same kind of foundation necessarily for the OR market. And to the extent that participants choose to submit their offers very precisely at the end of the auction, beside the anti-competitive potential implications related to offer transparency, this also just simply creates vulnerability to latency issues. So if there is a hiccup somewhere along, you know, in the participant submitting their offer or whatever it might be, that may result in the offer not being submitted. And we want to ensure that the market design isn't forcing people to do that without a good reason. And as I mentioned, offers that are not accepted or do not clear the market, they're not currently reported in any form. Next slide, please. So our proposed alternative is to move the OR markets to a sealed bid format. So that would align with the energy market. And so participants, when they submit their offer to the platform, it would not be visible by other participants. And then to align OR offer disclosure after the auction has been concluded with the energy offer disclosure that's stipulated by the FEOC regulation. And so we think that these two changes together would align the transparency and the sharing of information in the OR market with the energy market. And effectively, it would result in a reduction of real-time transparency while the auction is being conducted, but then an increase of ex post transparency with data after a 60-day lag. Next slide, please. So then the final design element in group one is the minimum qualification and offer size for OR. So the current practice, our minimum qualification size varies between products. So for regulating reserve, it is 15 megawatts. For spinning reserve, it's 10 megawatts. And for supplemental reserve, it is 5 megawatts. And the minimum offer size for all operating reserve is 5 megawatts. So you must have at least a 5 megawatt position, which means that your first offer must be at least 5 megawatts, and then subsequent offers or offer blocks can be in increments of 1 megawatt, I believe. And our dispatch tolerance is currently 1 megawatt for assets that are less than or equal to 20 megawatts in size, and 5% for assets that are greater than 20 megawatts in size. And so a few considerations with this practice. Firstly, if we're able to reduce the minimum qualification and offer size, we know that would allow for participation from more types of resources and a different diversity of sizing of resources. And we could also simplify our requirements by providing a uniform dispatch tolerance treatment across different asset sizes. And so our proposed alternative is to reduce the minimum qualification and offer size to 1 megawatt for all products, which is currently what our systems can support, and to change dispatch tolerance to 5% for all assets, which should make it feasible to monitor compliance for assets down to that 1 megawatt threshold. And with that, next slide, I think takes us to our next discussion. So I think that section went by pretty quickly, but we are now happy to have a discussion on any of those design elements, any of the considerations that we've mentioned, our proposed alternative, a few questions to get us started. Are there other considerations maybe that we have not taken into account for these design alternatives? Are there other options? Are there other alternatives that we should also be considering that we haven't identified here? And are there any opportunities where further quantitative or qualitative analysis would help to support the assessment of these alternatives?
We do have one hand up, Brendan, from Akira. I'm just going to put Akira through. You should be able to unmute now, Akira.
Can you hear me?
Yep. Yes.
Akira Yamamoto from TransAlta. Gone on about the reduction in operating reserve sizes. We've raised in different consultations, I think a couple. We've raised our concerns about this, and obviously, there from our perspective, we look at this as potentially creating many different issues. One of which is that we wish to have some better information from the ISO on, and so. One of the concerns that we do have is that larger units that are operating the operating reserves get activated or dispatched or directed on more frequently than small units. And we've not seen any stats that have given us any comfort on that perspective, that as you get to this, as the ISO continues to pursue this, that trend that you over dispatch large units compared to small units won't continue. And I think that definitely raises questions about whether the products you're providing are the same from an operating reserves perspective. I think there are also inherent issues about talking about a threshold of 1 megawatt unit that's measured in the kilowatts, because we don't think that you do compliance monitoring at that level. And so the penalty risk is entirely different for small providers than it is for larger providers. I think that there are numerous other issues in terms of the maintenance of this program and administration of it. We're having to pursue multiple small providers if they were to be non-compliant. I don't think that the ISO is really going to do that. So I think that becomes a bit of a penalty risk or a difference in penalty risk and product. We hope that you're going to address that rather than just continue to push forward with an idea that you've floated around almost a year and a half ago, without addressing any of the concerns that have been raised about it. But just look forward to additional information, at least from the ISO side, about the practicality of this, and some information that would give us a better perspective about what its implications might actually be, whether these are really, you're pursuing competition, but really creating different products using the same pricing mechanism to procure them. Thanks.
Thanks, Akira. So I think that we'll take back some of the comments you've mentioned, and we do recognize that some of those comments have been brought up in some previous consultations, and I think they're relevant to consider now, because we're looking at this change as part of our OR market review. In general, what I would say is that we do have established stringent technical requirements that apply to all assets in order to qualify to provide regulating reserve, spinning reserve, and supplemental reserve. And we have a very rigorous process in ensuring that that any new provider does qualify to provide those reserves. And I think when we talk about maximizing competition and reducing barriers to entry, it's important to ensure that we're allowing for a level playing field where any asset that can meet those technical requirements that we establish can participate in the market. Now, when it comes to your comment on dispatches and directives, I think in general, so dispatches occur when you're dispatched if you've cleared in the market, and on the standby market, it's according to activation price. Directives, generally, I think that's something that occurs when our operations folks look at what's their need at at a given time and what's required to meet a gap. But I think we definitely recognize your comments there, and something that we will take back as part of this review. And I think please include them as part of your comment matrix as well, and we can ensure we include that as well.
Okay. So we have a few questions now in the Q&A. I'm not sure. I'll go to Horst and allow him to talk first. Horst, you can go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I actually have comments on kind of two items. One is the standing offers. I think there's a risk with standing offers, particularly as the ISO described, when small participants often don't get contracts for kind of multiple days in a row. If there's a standing offer and the participant hasn't actually received any contract, kind of things might get forgotten. And then the one day where this contract is then, or the unit gets a contract, the unit might not be ready. The participant may not be ready. I think there's a real risk that, an offer is being included in clearing the market that is not in fact real. So I think that's a bigger concern than a market participant not wanting to spend the time and kind of the burden of kind of submitting the offer every day. So I think that needs to be kind of compared. And I would say at a minimum, there should be a kind of very short time limit for which kind of standing offer should kind of remain in the market, like not for months on end. So that's the comment on standing offers. And a question on offer transparency or comment. Do I understand correctly that what you're proposing is you submit sealed bids for each auction, the market clears, you just see the clearing price and whether you got volume, but that's it. And then you move to the next market and so on and so on. And that continues for 60 days until the first time you actually see information on kind of any of the markets that cleared previously?
So for your first comment, I think that's a really good risk to highlight, and we'll want to make sure that participants who have offers in the system are still able to fulfill those obligations and are ready to respond. So you mentioned potentially putting a timeout on those offers. I think that's a good option to explore. And I think we're also open to any other options that could help to mitigate that. So for the second thing regarding transparency, that sounds correct to me. So the offers would be submitted in a sealed bid format. Once the procurement ends for a particular product, the clearing price will be visible for that product, and you will know how much volume you cleared for before moving to the next product procurement sequentially. And then, yes, 60 days after the fact, we would release an ancillary services or OR merit order, much the same as we do for energy.
Okay, because as you're saying, compared to energy, I would say that that would mean that there's significantly less information in the AS market than there is in the energy market, because for the energy market, I can actually see system marginal price any minute of any day, and I can see how generators moving on the CSD page. So I actually get a real-time picture, and as I adjust my offers, I can take all that information into account, where here I have multiple products. I'm blind in all of them. I have no idea kind of how thick markets are, how tight things are. I think aligning sounds good, but actually would really obscure ancillary service markets way more than the energy market. Thanks.
So Horst, that's really interesting. I just want to make sure I fully understand that. Are you saying that, like, by the nature of shifts in demand, like that sort of traces out in a public fashion kind of the merit order to some extent, whereas that wouldn't happen to the same granularity in AS, and that creates an information difference? Is that sort of the nature? Okay.
Yeah, there's massive amount of real-time information available that tells me the status of the energy market, where I literally have just the clearing prices and then 60 days later market information for the AS markets. And kind of for small fractured markets, I really have no way to kind of have any kind of market intelligence then. And so...
Sorry. Go ahead.
No, just want to say that there's, as I said, alignment sounds good. It's just that that doesn't take into account that there's so much more information in real time in the energy market available.
So one thing that I'd want to share, and I'm interested to kind of definitely hear your thoughts on that's some of the misalignment there, but we do share dispatch contingency reserve on an asset by asset basis as part of our current supply and demand page. Now, it doesn't have the regulating reserve amounts, but we do have DCR. And so your dispatch contingency reserve, so you are able to see that. And it's current supply and demand, it's updating live. So that's something that I think should at least share some information. And then what we do share as well after the fact, after clearing, is on the settlement day, we have a report called the active operating reserve price report and the standby operating reserve price report that shows the amount, the total volume cleared, the what the equilibrium price was for those markets. So participants are able to match those up with the pool prices so that they can actually see what those settlement prices would look like for the operating reserve market. So we do have some data, but interested to hear if you think that that's insufficient and if there's additional data that that could share to kind of help the market.
Okay, so we can move on to the next. I'm going to go to the Q&A. We've got a few questions in there. So Cody Uyghur from Capital Power, has the ISO considered simplifying or further revising the AS delivery timeframes for both activations and or directives? It might be worth considering the limited responsiveness of the various generators being a barrier to participation, especially in larger quantities. Understandably, this would open some reliability concerns, but would like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. Sorry, Melissa, I'm just scanning the question again just to make sure that I understand it properly. Yeah, so I think this is... if I understand correctly, referring to the ability to respond to a directive / an activation, like for a certain period of time. I think, Cody, you'll see once we go into our group 2 design elements that We have block procurement and the way that blocks are defined for different time periods as one of our in-scope items in that group. And I think that this question might be best addressed kind of in tandem with that. So to the extent that you have feedback on the way that blocks are defined for different time periods and how maybe directives are defined for different time periods in our technical standards, I think that would kind of all go under that umbrella, but it's definitely something that we want to consider going forward.
Yeah, and I think generally review of technical requirements is largely out of scope of this specific review, but it is something that we can highlight to our operations teams who are closely linked in with the initiative, and something that they can consider. It's part of future assessments, because it sounds like your question, if I'm understanding it appropriately, it's the actual timeline, that you're required to respond following receiving an activation or a directive. And so that would be part of an operations assessment of technical requirements.
Thank you. So we'll do one more question from the Q&A and then we'll go back to the open phone question. So Ethan Natishan from TransAlta, how does the ISO currently determine operating reserve dispatches / directives? How would the ISO ensure dispatches would remain fair for participants of all unit sizes if the participation size changed?
Sure. So I think dispatches are based on those slides we covered earlier. Basically, we assemble a merit order of OR providers, and that's how we determine the dispatch for who is currently providing OR at any given time. Directives, however, that's when a reserve provider is actually directed to provide energy, to start flowing energy in response to a contingency. So I think, as Shazana was saying earlier, directives right now are basically met based on system controllers' needs at the time. And in order to manage real-time system conditions, they take the actions with the available reserve providers that are going to be effective in mitigating the issue. That being said, I think as we've also heard from Akira from TransAlta, that's definitely something we'll take away, is reviewing directives and the priority of directives, and ensuring that if assets are providing the same product and they're being paid for the same product, that they're held to the same standard and that they are used in a fair and consistent way. So I think that's definitely something that we'll take away and look into, and I'm sure we'll discuss that at a follow-up session.
Thank you, Brendan. So we're going to go to Parang Menon, and I will put you through. Parang is from Heartland. You should be able to unmute.
Thanks. It's Parag here from Heartland. So I had a question. We do have some concerns again related to the minimum qualification and the 1 megawatt level. There could be a potential problem, especially with the dispatch tolerance levels of 5% that's currently there on the assets, and also in future, if there is a large number of market participants who have all sold 1 megawatts, and if in case there is a frequency event, and then it would be hard to monitor whether all of them did perform appropriately and the system did. Was able to stabilize back if in case what we have 1 megawatt sold across a large group of players, and if they all part of the dispatch contingency or part of the tolerance level, they either couldn't do it or it was variable. So that's my concern there.
Sure. So I think that all makes sense. We have done some technical studies to support the idea that our current systems, our dispatch processes, our compliance processes, et cetera, are equipped to handle 1 megawatt of size with a 5% dispatch tolerance. We will be able to share some more details about some of the supporting findings in, I believe, our second session is when we'll be able to do that. But I believe we've heard that from you and from a couple other participants now. So sharing some more of the technical information that's behind our assessment that, you know, the capability for that is there. That's something that we can share and then discuss more and collect more feedback on in our second session.
Great. So I'll move over. We've got 6 minutes left in this Q&A portion. So in the Q&A, we have Curtis Glacier from I believe it's Heartland. What are the ISO's thoughts on allowing misalignment between the proposed 1 megawatt threshold with 5% dispatch tolerance being proposed for the OR markets and the current 5 megawatt threshold with a fixed allowable dispatch tolerance for energy market participants?
So I can start, and I don't know if maybe someone else will want to jump in after, but I think that is something we'd want to consider, is if it creates a misalignment and if there is a rationale for that misalignment or perhaps not. As I said, I think some of the technical backing for that current proposal is something that we can discuss more in a subsequent session. My initial thought is that, you know, the dispatch tolerance for different products may have different implications on the system, and therefore one product may need to have a tighter or a less stringent dispatch tolerance than another based on the impact it has to real-time operations and the stability and reliability on the system. You know, perhaps if that's not the case, or if there is there isn't a clear rationale for a difference, then that might be something to consider as we move forward.
I think we also need to think about the applicable dispatch tolerance based on the size. So the energy market, I think that when it comes to the, you know, the dispatch tolerance that's applicable for, you know, assets that are less than, I believe, 200 megawatts, and then greater than 200 megawatts, you get the 10 megawatt. But for the operating reserve market, where we could get, if we reduce the thresholds and see a lot of value there, then we need to kind of think about what's an applicable tolerance to make sure that we're getting the requirements we need from a reliability perspective, because they are ancillary service products. They are required for reliability and to support the overall function of the system. And so we're definitely open to hearing any feedback you have here on what's an appropriate tolerance, what's feasible for your specific asset. I think that would be really helpful for us to understand when we're taking this back and reviewing.
There's a follow-up echoing. I might have to get some more muting. So there's a follow-up from Cody. Appreciate the answer. And as a follow-up, perhaps I'm misunderstanding the scope and authority of this review. This review has, but if megawatt dispatch tolerance levels are in scope, 1 megawatt versus 5%, it may also be appropriate for response timelines, i.e. 10 minutes to meet the directive megawatt volume, might also be in scope. If it does fall within scope, it may be worth the ISO, considering the barriers to participation, considering quantity mostly, these timeframes may have.
Thanks, Cody. like Brett and I both unmuted at the same time. I think that's something that we'll take away. When we were thinking about the dispatch tolerance, it was specifically related to the compliance requirements related to that qualification size component of that rule. But we'll take away your comment and we'll consider it. Thank you.
Yeah, and just to add to what Shazana is saying, I think some of the requirements with the amount of time required, for example, the 10 minutes are based on reliability requirements, and we would have to make sure we have our technical team assess that, and they're there for specific reasons to recover from contingencies. And so, like Shoshana had mentioned, the tolerance levels, the change in tolerance levels and the reduction in the megawatt amount that's being considered for the oil market, we want to ensure that we also get the reserve that that's been paid for, because we need it for reliability purposes. Melissa?
Okay. So we have a couple more questions, and we're kind of out of time. So did you guys want to come back to these questions at the end, or would you like to continue through the Q&A? What do you think?
I think it probably makes sense for us to go through the next set of items. I think just having a quick, I haven't read them all, but just a quick scan of some of the remaining questions. I think some of them might be cleared up a little bit in the next section anyway. Okay. And then happy to use the remainder of the time to take whatever questions we have left.
Perfect. Okay. You can move to the next session then.
All right. So I think we can go to slide probably 61, I'm guessing. Yeah. So here we have the group two design elements. And so whereas the first group, they were thought to be lower cost, clearly identifiable alternatives, maybe broader benefits. These alternatives we expect to be much more complex and more substantial analysis will likely be needed in order to assess different alternatives for these. So we're introducing these topics today just so that all of our stakeholders can get a sense of what the scope is for future sessions, and to receive initial feedback on whether the suite of design elements we're looking at is appropriate. And also to the extent that some stakeholders may want us to look at something as part of this initiative, you'll be able to see whether or not it is already something that is included on the list of items for us to analyze, or whether it's something that should be brought up perhaps in the stakeholder matrix, for instance. So we recognize that stakeholders are going to require more information from future sessions before you can provide fulsome feedback on these design elements. And so you'll notice that today we're not sharing really considerations or issues with the current practice. And we haven't even proposed an alternative yet. So really, this is just an introduction. And I know that many of our stakeholders will be eager to discuss the details of these various design elements. But I think we're really not in a place to do that today, both because just simply from time, and also because some more analysis, I think, is needed. And we will need to set aside, I think, a substantial chunk of at least one, if not more, of our sessions just to cover these design elements. So with that, I think we can move to slide 62. So the first element is block procurement. So the ISO I mentioned earlier, we procure reserve in time blocks. There are four time blocks that we define. I won't go through all the nitty gritty of the timing for each of them, but generally we procure on peak, off peak, and then two different super peak blocks, being AM super peak and PM super peak. Active regulating reserve is procured for all four of those time blocks, whereas all other reserves are procured only in on peak and off peak time blocks. So what we'd like to assess is whether the current block definitions are facilitating competition, whether they are effective from an operational standpoint, and whether perhaps any changes to the definition of these blocks, the number of blocks, that sort of thing, would be prudent to explore further to improve efficiency. Next slide. So on slide 63, contingency reserve procurement. This slide is rather brief, but I think the issue could potentially be complex. And like I said, will require a substantial probably chunk of at least one of our future sessions. So currently spinning reserve and supplemental reserve, the two contingency reserves, they're procured separately in the sequential auction format. Our BAL002 WEC reliability standard is what dictates the quantities that we must hold for these contingency reserves. And it requires that of our total contingency reserve at any given time, a minimum of 50% of that contingency reserve must be spinning reserve. And so our proposed scope is to assess whether there's an alternative procurement mechanism that we could implement that may reflect the interrelated function of these products by clearing the lowest cost offers in combination of the two products. Rupa, I see a raised hand. Are you wanting to jump in on that? Maybe not.
Sorry, that was a mistake on my part.
Okay. No problem. All good. Currently, without going again into too much detail on this, because I think there is a lot more analysis that we'll need to share before we really talk about this in detail, but just to highlight kind of what we're looking at, we may be procuring SUP blocks or offer blocks when there were spinning reserve blocks procured that were not procured, rather, that were available at a lower price. And since spinning reserve can it can meet the same need as supplemental reserve because the BAL002 WEC standard is a minimum of 50%. It doesn't mean it has to be 50%. There's the potential that perhaps there's a way for us to link these procurements in order to reflect that the 50% is in fact a minimum. Moving to the next slide, 64. So operating reserve curtailment priority. So currently in operations, we, based on our ISO rules, we prioritize energy over ancillary services when we're resolving transmission constraints. Now, transmission constraints are less frequent and less substantial in Alberta than other jurisdictions due to our legislative planning standards. However, they do still occur. And our ISO rule 203.6, which handles allocation of available transfer capability on our interties, in particular when we're allocating joint ATC or system ATC, which is on the BC and Montana or the BC, Montana and Saskatchewan interties respectively. We currently prioritize energy interchange transactions before ancillary services interchange transactions. Similarly, when we're dealing with an internal constraint, ISO rule 302.1, it will prioritize energy when it's issuing curtailments to generators and to loads for the purpose of mitigating real-time transmission constraints. And so both of these instances, currently energy is given priority over AS. And so our proposed scope is to consider whether this current practice is still effective today or assess whether an alternative curtailment priority or an alternative mechanism for resolving these constraints may improve competition, improve the efficiency of our real-time operations, and or lead to lower overall costs. Next slide. Slide 65, standby reserves. So currently, as I mentioned earlier, we procure standby reserves in order to meet our reserve requirements when our active portfolio is insufficient. Market participants, they submit a two-part offer that includes a premium and an activation price to WATEX. I have described the blended price formula that includes the premium and a weighting of the activation price. The activation percentage determined by the ISO, and it was shared in that table earlier on in the presentation. And participants are paid the premium, and if they're activated, they're paid the activation price on a pay-as-bid basis. And so our proposed scope, firstly, is to assess the operational and economic purposes of standby reserves as a whole. So these reserves are used in order to fill in for our active portfolio when, for whatever reason, we do not have the active reserves we need in order to meet our reserve requirements. And so do standby reserves, are they effective in meeting that need? Is there perhaps an alternative mechanism that would be superior to procurement of standby reserves? And then to the extent that we do see value in procuring standby reserves, then we want to assess whether adjustments to the pricing mechanism may reduce the complexity of the standby reserve market, perhaps improve the incentives for how participants would offer into the standby reserve market, and ensure that the pricing mechanism is aligned with the underlying costs of providing the product. Next slide, please. So with that, one more slide. I'm going to hand it over to Rupa just to take us into our final discussion segment.
Thanks, Brendan. So we'll go through kind of like our path forward, and then we'll open up for Q&A again. So again, the focus of the session is to assess opportunities to enhance competition and price fidelity in the existing OR market to increase efficiency. As Brendan mentioned, at the highest level, the market is functioning, but there are several design elements that are not performing in a way that promotes efficiency. We think there is value in addressing these efficiency gains that also set the market up for success for any future changes that may be implemented. So Brendan has walked us through the recommendations for the Group 1 and Group 2 changes. For the Group 1 changes, it is the ISO's view that the case for the change is clear. For these design elements, there are clearly identifiable alternatives. They have broad benefits and are simple to implement. The Group 2 items are being introduced at this session to give insight into the content of subsequent sessions and to receive initial feedback. The ISO expects session 2 to happen in March 2022 to cover additional analysis of the Group 1 design elements, including stakeholder feedback, and to start discussions of alternatives and considerations for the Group 2 design elements. The ISO also expects to have subsequent session in May 2022 to cover the analysis of the Group 2 design elements, including stakeholder feedback, and to start the formation of final recommendations. Next slide. So we'll start the discussion on the Group 2 proposed items and just address some of the questions that we didn't answer in Group 1. So just to recap, the proposed in-scope items for Group 2 went through block procurement, contingency reserve procurement, OR curtailment priority, and standby reserve. There's a, I noticed there's some questions in the chat, in the Q&A, but just to kick off some of the discussion, are there any other design elements that should be considered in scope? And should there be any adjustments to the timing and or content of the future engagement sessions? So with that, maybe we can go into some of the Q&A. Melissa?
Yeah, it looks like there's a slide here from Troy McTavish. So I'll just read the first one, and then he has a follow-up. So Troy is from NMAX. From slide 32, you state one of the objectives of competition as competition across the energy and OR markets should be maximized. A narrow spread between OR costs and pool price would reflect this maximization from slide 26. The spreads from 2020 to 2021 don't look historically wide. Are there projections for 2022 plus similar to 2020-21? If so, would there be a concern about the competition?
So I can take that. I think if we go to slide 26, that might help give some context to the comment there. So I think I agree with the premise of your question that, you know, overall it looks like OR costs have tracked the pool price fairly closely throughout this time. And that is indicative of what we would expect given the kind of opportunity cost fundamentals of operating reserves. And so I think that was a large motivating factor in what informed the scope of this initiative and why we don't believe that broader changes are necessary. So that wasn't necessarily a foregone conclusion right out of the gate as we were kind of just kicking off this initiative. But when we went back and looked at, you know, these OR costs, we looked at the volumes that we've been able to procure. We think that overall the market is functioning at a high level. It's really these more incremental adjustments to pricing mechanisms where we're just seeing odd outcomes that aren't really promoting efficiency. We're seeing feedback from participants that they aren't able to participate in the way they'd like to. And it looks like we may be able to enable some more participation. So overall, I think there are still some concerns about competition, but our historical observations of the market do certainly lessen the extent of those concerns.
So Troy's next question is, if a participant isn't capable of submitting offers daily, how confident are you that you're going to be able to maintain compliance, such as restating out of AS if unable to provide?
So I think there's no question that making sure we have the right mechanisms in place for compliance, for ensuring that participants can meet our technical standards, ensuring that they provide the same product with the same quality as the providers we have today. I think all of those are critical when we're looking at potentially adjusting our qualification sizes and offer volumes. I think for standing offers, it's less a factor of whether they're capable of submitting offers daily and more whether it's reasonable for them to do so. I think we see participants who've responded to our survey that we expect would be perfectly capable of submitting offers, but they just choose not to because it would only be in rare circumstances that they'd clear the market. And so while they may have that capability, we think that some form of standing offer may help to have the merit order in the reserve markets reflect the capability that's actually there and ready to potentially provide reserves rather than just those that, you know, chose to submit an offer in that day. But definitely concern is duly noted and something we'll want to discuss more and figure out how to mitigate in our future sessions.
What I would also add to that as well is that we enable standing offers as part of the energy market. And we do see participants that see a lot of value at the energy market using that capability. And so, you know, having that kind of capability in the OR market does create some more or simplify participation in some manner. And so it's something that I think, you know, as Brendan mentioned, we have to make sure that we've got the right compliance mechanisms in place. And, you know, in the energy market, we have multiple tools and levers to rely on. In the OR market, we have many as well. And so it's just a matter of ensuring that we align those and make sure that when we're considering this as a possible option moving forward.
Okay. Next, we have Santi from Capital Power. Has the ISO considered the timing of this consultation with those of the ISO's initiatives on grid resilience and the ISO update study on revenue sufficiency? There may be key insights and takeaways from those initiatives to better inform the scope, timing, and appropriateness of potential alternatives identified in the OR review.
I can maybe just start that, and then I'm sure someone else may want to jump in. I think that, as Nicole mentioned with her setup to the session today, we do see the opportunities for these improvements in the market today, and it's likely that some of those changes that come out of some of those other initiatives may result in sort of longer-term realizations about the future path of the market, and that we think it's critical, especially given those initiatives, that we're ensuring that we have a good sort of foundation in the market that's set up with facilitating competition, set up to send good price signals, so that if there are adjustments to the suite of products or volumes that come out of those initiatives, that we're well prepared to integrate them. That being said, we are working very closely with the teams undertaking those initiatives internally to make sure that we're aligned and that we're, you know, proceeding in an efficient manner. I'll probably leave it there though, and if someone else wants to jump in.
Yeah, and I guess the only other thing I would add to that response is that, you know, as we've mentioned earlier as well, the scope of these changes are more incremental in nature and can likely occur in a shorter amount of time. When we consider some of these longer term questions around revenue sufficiency and flexibility requirements with a changing fleet, those changes could be potentially more broader in scope, could be potentially the introduction of new products. And so there could be a possibility that they would be more longer term in nature. And so that's just something that I think we're, again, working closely with the teams across the organization to ensure alignment. But it is something that the revenue sufficiency questions and those kind of broader type questions would be considered more separate from this review.
Thank you, Shazana. So we're going to go to Richard Penn from IPCA. Would you consider, rather than a day ahead market, day ahead OR market, that OR is procured 2 hours ahead, similar to energy?
So I believe that the current issues we're seeing, we think, can be integrated into the current structure of procuring day ahead on WADEX. So I don't think we see issues right now that we believe would require that move. That being said, I touched on in an earlier slide how some of the kind of design elements from other jurisdictions, they complement each other. And so to the extent that, you know, we saw a broader change in the future or the need to move perhaps some of our energy dispatch practices, procurement offer structure, those sorts of things. I think in the future, we may consider a broader change to both energy and OR as a whole. But for this initiative, we believe we can capture these incremental changes without changing the day ahead nature of the OR market.
Thank you, Brendan. Next, we'll go to Dwayne Asberg from Dow Chemicals Canada. Alignment of sealed offers sounds nice, but participants can restate energy offers in T+2. You need to align this capability as well.
So I think there are restatements that can occur in the OR market as well. So I don't know if I'm fully clear on this question. We have the ability to both restate and also the ability to perform substitutions to qualified providers in the OR market. But interested to hear if, Dwayne, I don't know if you wanted to unmute and maybe provide a little bit more information on your question. You can raise a hand if you'd like to, or if you'd like to just provide
it. Okay, now can you hear me now?
Yeah, thank you.
You can restate prices in T+2. You can't restate prices on your OR offers. They're fixed once the auction is set. Sure, you can substitute another asset, or you can change the volumes, but you can't change the price, and you can change your price in energy. So you're not dealing with apples and oranges. You're dealing with apples and Volvos.
I think that's important to take into consideration is the clearing mechanism, though. So clearing mechanism in the energy market occurs in real time. And so we're clearing constantly as we require, we're required to match energy and demand, essentially. And in the OR market, that clearing mechanism occurs day ahead. And so it's an important aspect of the market to ensure that the price is determined according to when it's cleared. And so that every participant has a good understanding of what the cleared price will be for their own, for whatever offer they had submitted that had cleared. And so I think that's something to take into account, that if we clear day ahead versus we don't clear real time for OR, that's an important distinction between the markets and why they're set up the way they are.
Well, okay, fine. Accept that, but you're not making it easier for for me to participate. If it was complicated before, it's still complicated. I'll seek other opportunities.
Okay, noted. Thanks, Wade.
Okay, thanks, Dwayne. So we have Scott Perry. Not sure where Scott's from. Greengate. So Scott Perry from Greengate. How does the timing of Group 1 and Group 2 sessions and the recommendations align with the current MSSC and operational reliability initiatives currently underway, which the ISO noted may have a direct link to the OR review?
As I mentioned earlier, the changes for this consultation will set us up for any future changes that may result from other consultations that are currently in progress, like the MSSC consultation. So we will continue, as mentioned before, this consultation is intended to increase the efficiency and competitiveness of the OR market. So any products or changes resulting from the MSSC engagement will be coordinated with market design, again, to set us up to move forward with implementing any future changes in an efficient manner. So we will coordinate we'll progress this work and then also coordinate with our operations team to ensure that everything works holistically from a market technical and reliability perspective.
Thank you, Rafa. We'll go to Emily now. Emily's from Voltus. Would you consider adding a move to an hourly market rather on peak, off peak in Group 1?
So I think that is more closely related to the block procurement question that we had in Group 2. So I think we're not quite ready to propose alternatives or sort of identify issues with that yet, but we can discuss that more in a future session. That being said, I think moving to an hourly product would probably be a bookend, if you will, of the alternatives related to block procurement. So to the extent that, that may facilitate competition from some providers, it may also remove certainty from others. And that's something that we're interested to hear the perspective of a variety of different market participants on that in future sessions and on how we can find a balance that facilitates the most competition.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Akira now. Where'd you go, Akira? Oh, someone's allowed to talk.
Akira Yamamoto from TransAlta. You outlined a plan and a timeline, and I think it kind of follows some of the comments that Scott Perry had mentioned. I'm very concerned about the way that you're scheduling these initiatives. And while you might think that they are discreet enough to be able to take action on, I think that a lot of the perspectives that you're getting in terms of changes, particularly if there are other changes that are expected in the OR market, is a problem. And for market participants, I think it's fine for the ISO to go out there and schedule the work. But for all of us that might be inefficiently engaged this consultation process, where we're engaged on one piece of information with some suggestion that it's a limited change, and then all of a sudden there's something else that has to, a new product has to get constructed, and that product gets dispatched complementary with other OR products. That's highly relevant for design change. And I think there's a significant amount of inefficiency in engaging stakeholders and multiple venues that might have interrelated impacts. So I would suggest to the ISO reconsider that schedule, because it sounds like there's a lot of stuff that might be coming out in that Q1 timeframe from the ISO that might be important for stakeholders to consider fully before we respond to your questions.
Thanks, Akira. And that's a very fair comment. We totally recognize that there are what are three parallel streams moving that do have interconnections. But I think as a team, we are deeply involved in all of them, and we have a good sense of what are the options that are being evaluated and the steps that will be taken forward in the short term versus the longer term, with that kind of consideration of new products being identified and developed. And we're moving forward with the OR market design review with that context, along with the context that we identified these issues back in November of 2019. And we do think it's important to increase as much competitiveness as we can into the OR market. So we are very cognizant of the balance, and we're going to be looking to make sure that we use stakeholders' time efficiently while also moving forward with what we think is an important initiative for the efficiency of the market.
And I do agree that you guys have a better sense of that, but I think that that's what I mean. That's what feels a little bit unfair, is that while the ISO internally might have some perspectives about all these things, how all these things are aligning, the stakeholders don't. And you're asking us to be engaged in a process where you have all the answers and we might not understand the directions you want to take with all these things. And that could alter the way that we actually comment. So I'd say just keep that in mind when we're kind of getting engaged, because when you hear a certain type of response, but we only heard 50% of the information that was relevant to that, my response might change materially if I understood the rest of the 50% that you've kind of staged in its release. So that is important to kind of consider as we move forward.
Okay, and for maybe not, you're likely already aware of it, Akira, but for other parties' knowledge, there was a presentation that was put out by the ISO. I think the reference was included in the question around operational preparedness and reliability readiness on October 7th. And in that presentation, there was a list of actions that the grid and reliability team is evaluating. And there's a large number of them that are, vast majority of them are independent from the OR market. There are two or three that could potentially impact the product qualifications and then a longer term design considerations. But those longer term design considerations will be driven by, I think, the much bigger questions around how is the fleet evolving and the grid changing, which Brendan touched on. Is those are much bigger, longer term initiatives. And we do think it's important to move forward with these, we'll say, incremental modifications to the OR review now.
Okay, so next I'm going to go back to the Q&A. Richard Penn has a question from IPCA. Would moving to a 2-hour ahead market not increase supply from example energy storage? Differences in load, I think it's supposed to say load, for schedulers?
So I think I can't really speak to whether that would increase participation from those entities. Those entities are one of several that we're hoping to collect feedback from throughout this engagement. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the two-hour ahead market proposal is not within our current proposed scope. I think the the suite of changes we're looking at, the suite of problems we're observing, can all be improved upon without adjusting our current procurement practice of the day ahead procurement through WADEX. That being said, there may be other ways that those types of assets may be able to have enhanced participation, and we're looking forward to feedback from them. For instance, on our block procurement segment, as one of these group two items, there may be adjustments there that can be made, and we're open to hearing where there may be adjustments in other areas that can promote participation. And just for what it's worth, we do see very active participation from energy storage, particularly in spinning reserves today, as well as participation from load and supplemental reserves. So that doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't, you know, more competition there that we can enable, but we do see participation from those types of assets.
Thank you, Brendan. I'm going to go to Parag Menon on the phone. Should have the ability to unmute.
Okay, can you hear me? Okay, thanks. So I had a question on the group one, especially on the sealed bid offer recommendation. So the current OR market design, when you trade on the WADEX platform, you can see all the market participants who came in, who got cleared, and who didn't get cleared. With the open sealed bid offers, I think the proposal is to have only the clearing price that's available, and then the players who have got, the participants who have cleared, they'll know how much volume that cleared. So, like, if you increase the intent is to have more transparency, do you think that by doing so, like, from now, that there'll be less transparency in terms of, now, as a market participant, I don't know how much of the volume got cleared and how much was not cleared and what was that pricing. So maybe there's something to consider while you design that sealed bid offer to have something in mind to bring in more transparency rather than taking it away.
Yeah, so I think we're definitely interested to hear your feedback on how that might impact you and your how you offer into the market, and not necessarily the details of that, obviously, but how it might impact the way that you're able to consider your offer strategy. That being said, I think you mentioned in there, like, trying to increase transparency, and I don't think that's necessarily what we're trying to do. I don't know that the adjustments to transparency we're making are increasing or decreasing necessarily. It's a bit of both. And so our objective is not just to increase transparency, but instead just to make sure that the transparency we have is appropriate. To the extent that increased transparency in real time can help to increase price discovery, and there's a lot of literature out there on that sort of thing, we think that the extent to which we're observing that in real time is quite limited, especially because of this sort of equilibrium practice that many market participants have undertaken, where they really only submit their offers in the last possible moments of the procurement, so that it doesn't really create an opportunity for other market participants to observe them and respond. So we think if we're not observing those sort of positive price discovery benefits of real-time transparency, then really the only thing left is the potential harm, as well as the technical issues that I discussed earlier. So very much hoping to hear your response on that, but that's kind of the initial thinking that's informed our proposed alternative.
Okay, so I'm gonna go back to the Q&A now. We have Santi, from Capital Power. For the next session, can the ISO provide implementation timelines and cost benefits, even if high-level estimates for the ISO's proposed alternatives? I think this would help stakeholders better grasp the OR review and its alignment with some of the longer timeframe initiatives. As a side question, can the ISO confirm that both Group 1 and Group 2 elements are being considered for a single application with the AUC, or will it be staged?
Yeah, I can start that, and if someone else wants to jump in, you're welcome. Firstly, the first part of the question, I think the implementation costs, the implementation timelines, those are things that we've just are at the very initial stages of exploring. And so we'll probably have some more information to share on that in future sessions, but I don't think we can guarantee like cost estimates being defined for all of the alternatives for all the design elements by that point. Part of the issue is that there's a bit of a chicken and egg problem where it's hard to move forward with assessing implementation of an alternative before we've at least started to form not necessarily consensus, but at least movement towards that alternative with stakeholders. That being said, that is something that we're looking to explore to the extent we can in future sessions. So I guess the answer is, to the extent that we can, we will be sharing that information, but it won't be a comprehensive assessment. The second question, I believe that they will be a single application, and we've just split them in for the purposes of this engagement in order to try to compartmentalize a little bit and make the conversation a little more structured. But if that's incorrect, I think someone correct me on that. But I believe it's a single application.
Yeah, it'll be a single application.
I think one thing just to add to that is we'll consider any other competing initiatives. And if there's anything that should be tacked on to another initiative and rather than here, I think that's something that we take back and consider what's appropriate. But in general, we're considering a single application to the AUC for this.
I think I also just want to add that we're also want to explore the options through this engagement. So we've listed out in scope items in group one and two, but especially in group two, we want to explore those further to understand, do they get input on, do they warrant the making the change? Is the benefit there? Is the complexity, or can it be implemented in line with kind of our narrow scope of incremental changes?
We can move on now to Luis Pando Lopez. He's a consultant. Considering OR is for reliability purposes, has the ISO considered changing to a must offer design similar to FERC instead of voluntary offer?
So I think we view that right now as a structural shift in the market and something that may have a substantial impact on some of our providers. And as I've mentioned for a few other questions, I think, Luis, the answer is probably similar, that we just don't see the need for that currently in order to address our currently identified issues. And we think that the proposals that we've set out thus far could be made within the scope of the voluntary participation model that we have.
Thank you, Brendan. Now we go to Cody Weger from Capital Power. Has the ISO considered long-term commitments and contracts to secure AS volumes versus day-ahead auctions? Securing X ratio of these contracts versus auction volume might increase further participation and help navigate some barriers to entry concerns.
So I think you'll probably get a similar answer again, Cody, that I think we don't see that as being necessary currently. I believe, a while ago, work was actually done in order to consolidate OR procurement into our single day ahead format, and that we used to procure it in separate procurements based on different durations, but there were, I think, some issues with that, and we moved to the single procurement format we have today in order to simplify and increase transparency and competition. So I think currently that's not something that we're assessing as part of this initiative.
Thank you, Brendan. I'm going to go to Parag Manon again on the phone. He should be able to get through now.
Thanks, Brendan. So as a follow-up to my earlier question about having more information does change the offer behavior. I won't want to go much in detail, but as you see, in an open competitive market, the price is usually designed by supply and demand. So having an understanding of how much supply is there as each market subsequently clear does change my offer behavior. So I just want to have a little more understanding for you in terms of how market participants change getting more information in terms of their offer behavior as well.
Thanks. I think we can take that forward. I think we have a basic understanding at least of how that transparency might impact the market and whether it clears at the intersection of supply and demand and how participants might update their expectations and respond in order to what they're observing the offer behavior from other participants. And so I think that's some helpful clarity that we'll take forward when we're considering transparency changes.
Thank you. We have one more question in the Q&A from Ethan Natishan with TransAlta. Does the ISO have an estimate of the number of generators currently excluded under the current capacity rules, which would become eligible with the change to size of 1 megawatt?
I think the quick answer to your question is no. In our participant surveys that we conducted, we did hear from various participants that perhaps there was the opportunity for some new entry below those current minimum size thresholds. But we haven't done an assessment of what's currently out there. And without speculating too much, I suspect that if the qualification volumes were to change, that may also influence investment decisions into those types of resources in the future to some extent as well.
I'll also add that we did go through a stakeholder consultation in the distribution energy resources market participation work, and there was interest in reducing the minimum size thresholds down. And Brendan says we don't have any specific numbers yet, but the idea was that the feedback was that it was quite positive on moving the thresholds down, and it's kind of aligned with other jurisdictions on increasing the participation in those markets. And again, that's paired up with the change in tightening up the dispatch tolerances as well.
Thank you, Rupa. There is no more questions. Do you want to wrap it up?
Yeah, thanks very much, everyone, for participating. Lots of good input provided today, and thoughts for us to take away and consider as we prepare to move forward with the options. And did I jump in when I wasn't supposed to, Rupa? Is this your thing?
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
You get last.
I think we're going to say the same thing. We had a lot of great discussion today. We thank everybody for their insights, the time they took to attend the session, the discussions, the feedback. We value stakeholder feedback, and we look forward to your input in the comment matrix that will be published following the session. Nicole, anything further to add?
All right. Thank you, everybody, for participating today, and we'll see you at our next session.